From PRI, Public Radio International.
There's a melody in my head that I'd like to try. Oh, yes, I know all about that, said Mrs. Thayer. You just think you've got to entertain us. Nothing doing. We invited you here for yourself, not to enjoy your talent. I'd be a fine one to ask you to my house for a rest and then make you perform. You're not making me, said Ben. Honestly, I want to play for just 5 minutes. I've got a tune that I might do something with, and I'm anxious to run it over. I don't believe you, you naughty man.
You're listening to Christina Pickles reading from Ringlardner's Liberty Hall, which we'll be hearing later on today's edition of Selected Shorts, a series that originates in live performance on stage at Symphony Space in New York City. I'm Isaiah Sheffer. In both of these two stories you're about to hear, silence plays a major role. In fact, the first one by Kevin Brockmeyer is entitled The Year of Silence, and it was included in the Best American Short Stories 2008, edited by Salman Rushdie. Reading The Year of Silence is Anthony Rapp.
Shortly after 2 in the afternoon, on Monday the 6th of April, a few seconds of silence overtook the city. The rattle of the jackhammers, the boom of the transformers, and the whir of the ventilation fans all came to a halt. Suddenly there were no car alarms cutting through the air, no trains scraping over their rails, no steam pipes exhaling their fumes, no peddlers shouting into the streets. Even the wind seemed to hesitate. We waited for the incident to pass, and when it did, we went about our business. None of us foresaw the repercussions. 2. That the city's whole immense carousel of sound should stop at one and the same moment was unusual, of course, but not exactly inexplicable. We had witnessed the same phenomenon on a lesser scale at various cocktail parties and interoffice minglers over the years, when the pauses in the conversations overlapped to produce an air pocket of total silence, making us all feel as if we'd been caught eavesdropping on one another. True, no one could remember such a thing happening to the entire city before, but it was not so hard to believe that it would. 3. A handful of people were changed by the episode, their lives redirected in large ways or small ones. The editor of a gossip magazine, for instance, came out of the silence determined to substitute the next issue's lead article about a movie star for one about a fashion model, while her assistant realized that the time had come for her to resign her job and apply for her teaching license. A lifelong vegetarian who was dining in the restaurant outside the art museum decided to order a porterhouse steak, cooked medium rare. A would-be suicide had just finished filling his water glass from the faucet in his bathroom when everything around him seemed to stop moving, and the silence passed through him like a wave, bringing with it a sense of peace and clarity he had forgotten he was capable of feeling. He put the pill bottle back in his medicine cabinet. Such people were the exceptions, though. Most of us went on with our lives as though nothing of any importance had happened until the next incident occurred some 4 days later. 4. This time the silence lasted nearly 6 seconds. 10 million sounds broke off and recommenced like an old engine marking out a pause and catching spark again. Those of us who had forgotten the first episode now remembered it. Were the two occasions connected, we wondered, and if so, how? What was it, this force that could quell all the tumult and noise of the city, and not just the clicking of the subway turnstiles and the snap of the grocery store awnings, but even the sound of the street traffic, that oceanic rumble that for more than a century had seemed as interminable to us as the motion of the sun across the sky? Where had it come from? And why didn't it feel more unnatural? These questions nettled at us. We could see them shining out of one another's eyes. But a few days passed before we began to give voice to them. The silence was unusual, and we were not entirely sure how to talk about it. Not because it was too grave and not because it was too trivial, but because it seemed grave one moment and trivial the next. And so no one was quite able to decide whether it mattered enormously or not at all. 5. A stand-up comedian performing on one of the late-night talk shows was the first of us to broach the subject, albeit indirectly. He waited for a moment in his act when the audience had fallen completely still and then halted in mid-sentence, raising one of his index fingers in a listening gesture. A smile edged its way onto his lips. He gave the pause perhaps 1 second too long, just enough time for a trace of self-amusement to show on his face, then continued with the joke he had been telling. He could not have anticipated the size of the laugh he would receive. 6. The next morning's newspapers had already been put to bed by the time the comedian's routine was broadcast. The morning after that, though, the first few editorials about the silence appeared. Then the radio hosts and TV commentators began to talk about it, and soon enough it was the city's chief topic of conversation. Every family dinner bent around to it sooner or later, every business lunch, every pillow talk. The bars and health clubs all circulated with bets about the phenomenon. $10 says the government had something to do with it, $20 says it will never happen again. When 2 full weeks went by without another incident, our interest in the matter threatened to shrivel away. It might actually have done so had the next episode not occurred the following Sunday, surprising us all in the middle of our church services. There was another silence, more than 10 seconds long, just a couple of days later, and a much shorter silence, like a hiccup, the day after that. Every time one of the silences came to an end, we felt as though we had passed through a long, transparent passageway, a tunnel of sorts, one that made the world into which we emerged appear brighter and cleaner than it had before, less troubled, more humane. The silence siphoned out of the city and into our ears, spilling from there into our dreams and beliefs, our memories and expectations. In the wake of each fresh episode, a new feeling flowed through us, full of warmth and a lazy equanimity. It took us a while to recognize the feeling for what it was. Contentment. 7. The truth was that we enjoyed the silence, and more than that, we hungered for it. Sometimes we found ourselves poised in the doorways of our homes in the morning or on the edges of our car seats as we drove to work, trying to hear something very faint beneath the clatter of sirens and engines. Slowly we realized that what we were waiting for was another incident to take place. There were weeks when we experienced an episode of silence almost every day. One particular Wednesday saw 3 of them in the span of a single hour. But there were other weeks when what the papers took to calling a silence drought descended upon the city, and all our hopes for a cessation went in vain. If more than a few days passed without some minor lull to interrupt the cacophony, we would become irritable and over-tender, quick to gnash at one another and then to rebuke ourselves for our failures of sympathy. On the other hand, a single interlude of silence might generate an aura of fellow feeling that could last for the better part of a day. The police blotters were nearly empty in the hours following a silence. The drunks in the bars turned amiable and mild. The jails were unusually tranquil. The men who ran the cockfights in the warehouses down by the docks said that their birds lost much of their viciousness after the great roar of the city had stopped, becoming as useless as pigeons, virtually impossible to provoke to violence. And there was another effect that was just as impressive. The doctors at several hospitals reported that their mortality rates showed a pronounced decline after each incident, and their recovery rates a marked increase. No, the lame did not walk and the blind did not see, but patients who were on the verge of recuperating from an injury often seemed to turn the corner during an episode, as if the soundlessness had triggered a decision somewhere deep in the cells of their bodies. Surely the most dramatic example was the woman at Mercy General who came out of a prolonged coma in the space of a 5-second silence. First her hand moved, then her face opened up behind her eyes, and soon after the noise of the hospital re-emerged, she moistened her lips and said, "Everything sounded exactly the same to me." The doctors had a hard time convincing her that she was in fact awake. 8. The silence proved so beneficial to us that we began to wish it would last forever. We envisioned a city where everyone was healthy and thoughtful, radiant with satisfaction, and the sound of so much as a leaf lighting down on the sidewalk was as rare and as startling as a gunshot. 9. Who was the first person to suggest that we try generating such a silence ourselves, one that would endure until we chose to end it? No one could remember. But the idea took hold with an astonishing tenacity. Local magazine published laudatory cover stories on the silence movement. Leaflets with headings like "Promote Silence" and "Silence Equals Life" appeared in our mailboxes. The politicians of both major parties began to champion the cause, and it wasn't long before a measure was passed decreeing that the city would make every possible effort to muffle all sources of noise within its borders so as to ensure a continuing silence for its citizens and their families. The first step, and the most difficult, was the dampening of the street traffic. We were encouraged, first of all, to ride the subway trains, which were appointed with all the latest noise alleviation devices, including soft fiber pressure pads and magnetic levitation rails. Most of the cars that were left on the road were equipped with silently running electric engines, while the others had their motors fitted with mineral wool shells that allowed them to operate below the threshold of hearing. The roads themselves were surfaced with a reinforced open-cell foam that absorbed all but the lowest frequency sounds, a material that we also adapted for use on our sidewalks and in our parking garages. Once the street traffic was taken care of, we turned our attention to the city's other sources of noise. We sealed the electrical generators behind thick layers of concrete. We placed the air conditioning equipment in non-resonant chambers. We redesigned the elevators and cargo lifts, replacing their metal components with a clear, durable plastic originally developed by zoos as a display barrier to prevent the roars of the lions from reaching the exhibits of the prey animals. Certain noises that weren't essential to either the basic operations or the general aesthetic texture of the city were simply banned outright. Canned music, church bells, fireworks, ringtones. 10. We were exultant when the roads fell silent and pleased when the elevators stopped crying out on their cables, but by the time the cell phones and the pagers ceased to chirp, we were faced with a problem of diminishing returns. The greater the number of sounds we extinguished, the more we noticed the ones that remained, until even the slightest tap or ripple began to seem like an assault against the silence. A clock ticking inside a plastic casing. Water replenishing itself in a toilet tank. A rope slapping languidly against a flagpole. A garbage disposal chopping at a stream of running water. The flat buzzing of a fluorescent light. A modem squealing its broken tune. A deodorizer releasing its vapor into the air. An ice maker's slow cascade of thumps. One by one, perhaps, these sounds were of little account, but added together, they grew into a single vast sonority, and no matter how many of them we were able to root out, we kept discovering others. Now and then, while we were working to eliminate the noise of a match taking light or a soda can popping open, another episode of true silence would occur, a bubble of total peace and calm enwrapping the city in its invisible walls, and we would be reminded of the magnitude of what we were striving for. How inexcusably flimsy, we realized, was the quiet we had managed to create. We redoubled our efforts. 11. We were more resourceful than we had imagined. It seemed that for every noise that cropped up, there was at least one person in the city who was prepared to counteract it. An engineer, bothered by the medical helicopter that beat by his office a dozen times a day, drew up plans for a special kind of rotor blade, one that would slice through the air as smoothly as a pin sliding into a pincushion. He handed the plans over to the hospital. Within a few weeks, the helicopter drifted so quietly past his window that he was surprised each time he saw it there. A single mother raising an autistic son, who was provoked to fits of punching by the tone of her doorbell, devised an instrument that replaced the sound with a pulsing light. She said that her son liked to sit on the floor watching now as she pressed the button again and again, a wobbly grin spreading over his face like a pool of molasses. A carpenter designed a nail gun that would soak up the noise of its own thud. A schoolteacher created a frictionless pencil sharpener. An antiques dealer who liked to dabble in acoustic engineering invented a sonic filter that could comb the air of all its sounds before releasing it into the room. Eventually, every noise but the muffled sigh of our breathing and the ticking of our teeth in our mouths had been removed from the inside of our buildings. The wind continued to blow, and the rain continued to fall, and No one had yet proposed a method to keep the birds from singing. But as long as we did not venture outside, we remained sealed in a cocoon of silence. 12. There were times when the silence was close to perfect. Whole minutes went by after the early morning light breached the sky when the surging, twisting world of sound left us completely alone, and we could lie there on our bed simply following our ruminations. We came to know ourselves better than we had before, or if not better, then at least in greater stillness. It was easier for us to see the shapes we wished our lives to take. People changed their jobs, took up chess or poker, began new courses of exercise. A great many couples made their marriage vows, and not a few others filed for divorce. One boy, an 8-year-old who attended the Holy Souls Parochial Academy, left school as the rest of his class was walking to the lunchroom, rode the subway to the Natural History Museum, and found his way to the dinosaur exhibit. He waited until the room had emptied out and then stole beneath the Tyrannosaurus, using the giant ribs of the skeleton to climb up to the skull. He was found there late that evening by a security guard, sitting hungry but uninjured on the smoothly curving floor of the jaw. The boy had left a note in his teacher's paper tray explaining himself. He had dreamed that the dinosaur was still roaring, the note said, but so weakly that the sound could only be heard from directly inside its head. He wanted to find out if it was true. 13. The boy who climbed the Tyrannosaurus was not the first of us to feel that his dreams were blending together with his reality. There was something about the luxuriousness of our situation that made it tempting to imagine that the space outside our heads was conforming to the space inside. Yet we did not really believe that this was so. It was just that we were seeing everything with a greater clarity now, both our minds and our surroundings, and the clarity had become more important to us than the division. 14. The silence was plain and rich and deep. It seemed infinitely delicate, yet strangely irresistible, as though any one of us could have broken it with a single word if we had not been so enraptured. Every so often, another natural episode would take place, and for a few seconds, the character of the silence would change slightly, the way the brightness of a room might alter as some distant roller in the current surged through a light bulb. But the quiet we had generated was so encompassing by now that only the most sensitive among us could be sure that something had truly happened. 15. In the abundant silence, we proceeded into ourselves. We fell asleep each night, woke each morning, and went about our routines each day, doing the shopping and preparing our tax returns, making love and cooking dinner, filing papers and cupping our palms to our mouths to check the smell of our breath, all in the beautiful hush of the city. Everywhere we could see the signs of lives in fluctuation. A librarian who had worked in the periodicals room for almost 3 decades began displaying her oil paintings at an art gallery, hundreds of them, all on lending slips she had scavenged from the library's in-out tray. Each tiny piece of paper flexed with the weight of the paint that had hardened onto it. The flyers at the gallery door proclaimed that the woman had never had the nerve to show her work before the silence was established. The bursar at the university was caught skimming money from the school's pension fund. In her letter of resignation, she said she was ashamed only that she had been found out. If there was one thing the silence had taught her, she wrote, it was that any grief which befell a professor emeritus could never be more than a fraction of what he deserved. A visiting gymnast giving an exhibition on the pommel horse at the Midtown Sports Club fractured his wrist while doing a routine scissor movement. But up until the moment of the accident, he reported, the audience in the city was the most respectful he had ever seen. Barely a cough or a rustle among them. 16. Gradually, as we grew used to the stillness, the episodes of spontaneous and absolute silence came less frequently. There might be a 3-second burst 1 week, followed by a 1-second flicker a few weeks later, and then, if the episodes were running exceptionally heavy, another 1-second echo a week or two after that. One of the physicists at the city's Lakes and Streams Commission came up with what he called a skipping rock model to describe the pattern. The distribution of the silence, he suggested, was like that of a rock skipping over the water, and then if one could imagine such a thing, doubling back and returning to shore. At first, such a rock would land only rarely, but as it continued along its path, it would strike down more and more rapidly until eventually the water would seize it and it would sink. But then, according to the paradigm, the rock would be ejected spontaneously through the surface to repeat its journey in reverse, hitting the water with increasing rarity until it landed back in the hand of the man who had thrown it. The physicist could not explain why the silence had adopted this behavior, or who, if anyone, had thrown it. He could only observe that it had. 17. Some 8 months after the first incident took place, it had been so long since anyone had noticed one of the episodes that it seemed safe to presume they were finished. The city was facing an early winter. Every afternoon, a snow of soft, fat flakes would drift gently down from the sky, covering the trees and the pavilions, the mailboxes and the parking meters, the streets and the sidewalks. Recalling the way the snow used to soften the noise of the traffic made us experience a flutter of helpless nostalgia. Everything was different now. The sound of our footsteps creaking over the fresh accumulation was like a horde of crickets scraping their wings together in an empty room. Not until we walked through the snow did we really discover how accustomed we had grown to the silence. 18. We might have been content to go on as we were forever, whole generations of us being born into the noiseless world, learning to crawl and stand and tie our shoes, growing up and then apart, setting our pasts aside and then our futures, and finally dying and becoming as quiet in our minds as we had been in our bodies, had it not been for another event that came to pass. It was shortly after 9 a.m. on Tuesday, January the 26th, when a few seconds of sound overtook the city. There was a short circuit in the system of sonic filters we had installed in our buildings, and for a moment the walls were transparent to every noise. The engine of a garbage truck backfired. A cat began to yowl. A rotten limb dropped from a tree and shattered the veneer of ice over a pond. 10,000 people suddenly struck their knees on the corner of a desk, or remembered a loss they had forgotten, or slid into an orgasm beneath the bodies of their lovers and cried out in pain or grief or sexual ecstasy. The period of noise was abrupt and explosive, cleanly defined at both its borders. Instinctively, we found ourselves twisting around to look for its source. Then the situation corrected itself, and just like that, we were reabsorbed in the silence. It seemed that the city had been opened like a tin can. So much time had gone by since we had heard our lives in their full commotion that we barely recognized the sound for what it was. The ground might have fallen in. The world might have ended. 19. Four days later, another such incident occurred, this one almost 8 seconds long. It was followed the next week by a considerably shorter episode, as brief as a coal popping in a fire, which was itself followed a few days later by a fourth episode, and immediately after by a fifth and a sixth, and early the next afternoon by a seventh. We were at a loss to account for the phenomenon. A cryptographer employed by the police force announced his belief that both the episodes of silence and the episodes of clamor resembled communications taking the form of Morse code, though from whom or what he could not say. A higher intelligence? The city itself? Any answer he might give would be no more than speculation. His hunch was that the sender, whoever it was, had resorted to using noise because we had ceased to take note of the silence. He said that he was keeping a record of the dots and dashes and hoped to be able to decipher the message very soon. 20. The cryptographer's theory bore all the earmarks of lunacy, and few of us pretended to accept it, but it was at least a theory. Every so often another event would transpire, interrupting the stillness with a burst of shouts and rumbles, and we would stop whatever we were doing, our arms and shoulders braced as if against some invisible blow, and wonder what was going on. Many of us began to look forward to these eruptions of sound. We dreamed about them at night. We awaited them with a feeling of great thirst. The head of the city's notary public department, for instance, missed the noise of the Newton's cradle he kept in his office, the hanging metal balls clicking tack, tack, tack against each other as they swayed back and forth. The cab driver, who began his circuit outside the central subway terminal every morning, wished that he was still able to punch his horn at the couriers who skimmed so close to his bumper on their bicycles. The woman who ran the Christian gift store in the shopping mall designed a greeting card with an illustration of a trio of kittens playing cymbals, bagpipes, and a tuba on the front. The interior caption read, "Make a joyful noise unto the Lord." She printed out 100 copies to stock by the cash register, along with 23 more to mail to the members of her Sunday school class. 21. It turned out that in spite of everything the silence had brought us, there was a hidden longing for sound in the city. So many of us shared in this desire that a noise club began operating, tucked away in the depths of an abandoned recording studio. The people who went to the club did so for the pure excitement of it, for the way the din set their hearts to beating. Who needed serenity, they wanted to know. Who had ever asked for it? They stood in groups, listening to the club's switchboard operator laying sound upon sound in the small enclosed space of the room. The slanting note of a violin, the pulse of an ambulance siren, gallons of water geysering from an open hydrant, a few thousand football fans cheering at a stadium. Afterward, when the club's patrons arrived home, they lay on their pillows, unable to fall asleep, their minds spinning with joy and exhilaration. 22. The episodes continued into the spring, falling over the city at intervals none of us could predict. Whenever we became most used to the silence, it seemed, the fundamental turmoil of the world would break through the tranquility and present itself to us again. More and more people began to prefer these times of disruption. They made us feel like athletes facing a game, like soldiers who had finished their training, capable of accomplishing great things in battle. A consensus slowly gathered among us. We had given up something important, we believed. The fire, the vigor that came with a lack of ease. We'd lost some of the difficulty of our lives, and we wanted it back. 23. The city council drafted a measure to abolish the silence initiative. After a preliminary period of debate and consideration, it was adopted by common consent. The work of breaking the city's silence was not nearly as painstaking as the work of establishing it had been. With the flip of a few switches and the snip of a few wires, the sonic filters that had sheltered our buildings were disabled, opening our walls up to every bird call and thunderclap. Scrapers and bulldozers tore up the roads, and spreading machines laid down fresh black asphalt. The cloth was unwound from the clappers of the church bells. The old city buses were rolled out of the warehouses. A fireworks stand was erected by the docks, and a gun club opened up behind the outlet mall. A man in a black suit carried an orange crate into the park one evening to preach about the dangers of premarital sex. A man with a tattoo of a teardrop on his cheek set 3 crisply folded playing cards on a table and began shuffling them in intersecting circles, calling out to the people who walked by that he would offer $2, 2 clean, new, green, new George Washington dollar bills to anyone who could find that lovely lady, that lady in red, the beautiful Queen of Hearts. 24. In a matter of weeks, we could hear cell phones ringing in restaurants again, basketball slapping the pavement, car stereos pouring their music into the air. Everywhere we went, we felt a pleasurable sense of agitation. And if our interactions with each other no longer seemed like the still depths of secluded pools, where enormous fish stared up at the light sifting down through the water, well, the noise offered other compensations. We became more headstrong, more passionate. Our sentiments were closer to the surface. Our lives seemed no less purposeful than they had during the silence, but it was as if that purpose were waiting several corners away from us now, rather than hovering in front of our eyes. For a while, the outbreaks of sound continued to make themselves heard over the noise of the city, just as the outbreaks of silence had, but soon it became hard to distinguish them from the ongoing rumble of the traffic. There were a few quick flashes of noise during the last week of May, but if they carried on into the summer, we failed to notice them. In their place were dogs tipping over garbage cans, flatbed trucks beeping as they backed out of alleys, and fountains spilling into themselves again and again. The quiet that sometimes fell over us in movie theaters began to seem as deep as any we had ever known. We had a vague inkling that we had once experienced our minds with a greater intimacy, but we could not quite recover the way it had felt. 25. Every day the silence that had engulfed the city receded further into the past. It was plain that in time we would forget it had ever happened. The year that had gone by would leave only a few scattered signs behind, like the imprints of vanished shells in the crust of a dried lake bed, the exemplary hush of our elevators, the tangles of useless wires in our walls, and the advanced design of our subway lines fading slowly into antiquation. that in a short item published in the Thursday, July the 8th edition of the Morning Newspaper, a letter detailing the results of the log the police department's cryptographer had been keeping. A repeating series of dots and dashes whose meaning was explicit, he said, but whose import he could not fathom. Dot, dash, dot, 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 dash, dot, dash, dot, dot, dash, dash, dot, dot, dash, dot, 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 dash, dot, dot.
Anthony Rapp read Kevin Brockmeyer's story, The Year of Silence. We'll be back in a flash with a very funny Ring Lardner tale. You're listening to Selected Shorts, recorded live in performance at Symphony Space in New York City and at other venues nationwide, from PRI, Public Radio International. Welcome back to Selected Shorts. In our first story, the world is silenced, but our second tale is about another kind of silence entirely, the kind that looms when the company you're in is excruciatingly annoying. In the journalist and sports writer Ring Lardner's story, Liberty Hall, which you're about to hear read by Christina Pickles, the sophisticated show business couple, trapped in a ghastly, chatter-filled weekend of the country, take extraordinary measures to escape.
My husband is in Atlantic City, where they're trying out Dear Dora, the musical version of David Copperfield. My husband wrote the score. He used to take me along for these out-of-town openings, but not anymore. He, of course, has to spend almost all his time in the theater, and that leaves me alone in the hotel, and pretty soon people find out whose wife I am and introduce themselves. And the next thing you know, they're inviting us for a week or a weekend at Dobbs Ferry or Oyster Bay. Then it is up to me to think of some legitimate-sounding reason why we can't come. In lots of cases, they say, well, if you can't make it the 22nd, how about the 29th? And so on. Till you simply have to accept. And Ben gets mad and stays mad for days. He absolutely abhors visiting and thinks there ought to be a law against invitations that go beyond dinner and bridge. He doesn't mind hotels where there's a decent light for reading in bed and one for shaving and where you can order meals with coffee any time you want them. But I really believe he would rather spend a week in the death house at Sing Sing than in somebody else's home. 3 or 4 years ago, we went around quite a lot with a couple who I will call the Buckleys. We liked them, and they liked us. We had dinner together at least twice a week, and after dinner we played bridge or went to a show or just sat and talked. Ben never turned down their invitations and often actually called them up himself and suggested parties. Finally, they moved to Albany on account of Mr. Buckley's business. We missed them a great deal, and they missed us. And when Mrs. Buckley wrote for us to come up for the holidays, we were tickled pink. Well, their guest room was terribly cold. It took hours to fill the bathtub. There was no reading lamp by the bed. 3 reporters called to interview Ben, 2 of them kittenish young girls. The breakfast was just fruit and cereal and toast, and coffee was not served at luncheon. The faucets in the wash basin were the kind that won't run unless you keep pressing on them. 4 important keys on the piano were stuck, and people were invited in every evening to hear Ben play. And the Buckley family had been augmented by a tremendously large police dog who was just a puppy and never growled or snapped at anyone he knew, but couldn't seem to remember that Ben was not an utter stranger. On the 4th awful day, Ben gave out the news to him and to me, as well as to our host and hostess, that he had lost a filling which he would not trust anyone but his own New York dentist to replace. We came home, and we have never seen the Buckleys since. If we do see them, it'll be an accident. They will hardly ask us there unless we ask them here, and we won't ask them here for fear that they would ask us there. And they were honestly the most congenial people we ever met. It was after our visit to the Craigs at Stamford that Ben originated what he calls his emergency exit. We had such a horrible time at the Craigs and such a worse time getting away that Ben swore he would pay no more visits until he could think up a graceful method of curtailing them in the event they proved unbearable. Here is the scheme he hit on. He would write himself a telegram and sign it with the name Ziegfeld or Jean Buck or Dillingham or George M. Cohan. The telegram would say that he must return to New York at once, and it would give a reason. Then the day we started out, he would leave it with Irene, the girl at Harms, his publishers, with instructions to have it sent to him 24 hours later. When it arrived at whatever town we were in, he would either have the hostess or hostess take it over the telephone or ask the telegraph company to deliver it so he could show it around. We would put on long faces and say how sorry we were, but of course business was business, and so goodbye, and so forth. There was never a breath of suspicion, even when the telegram was ridiculous, like the one Ben had sent to himself at Spring Lake, where we were staying with the Marshalls just after Betty's birthday opened at the Globe. The Marshalls loved musical shows, but knew less than nothing about music, and swallowed this one whole. Shaw and Miss Miller, both suffering from laryngitis, stop. Entire score must be rewritten half tone lower, stop. Come at once, stop. If miraculously Ben had ever happened to be enjoying himself, he would, of course, have kept the contents of his message a secret, or else displayed it and remarked swaggeringly he wasn't going to let any so-and-so theatrical producer spoil his fun. Ben is in Atlantic City now, and I have read every book in the house, and I'm writing this just because there doesn't seem to be anything else to do. And also because we have a friend, Joe Frazier, who's a magazine editor, and the other day I told him, I'd like to try my hand at a short story, but I was terrible at plots. And he said plots weren't essential. Look at Ernest Hemingway. Most of his stories have hardly any plot, and it's style that counts. And Mr. Frazier, suggested that I write about our visit to Mr. and Mrs. Thayer in Lansdowne outside of Philadelphia, which Mr. Frazier said might be termed the visit that ended visits, and which is the principal reason why I am here alone. Well, it was a beautiful night a year ago, last September. Ben was conducting the performance Step Lively, and I was standing at the railing at the boardwalk in front of the theatre watching the moonlight on the ocean. A couple, whom I'd noticed in the dining room, stopped alongside of me, and pretty soon the woman spoke to me something about how pretty it was. Then came the old question, wasn't I Mrs. Ben Drake? I said I was, and the woman went on, my name is Mrs. Thayer, Hilda Thayer, and this is my husband. We are both simply crazy about Mr. Drake's music and just dying to meet him personally. We wondered if you and he would have supper with us after the performance tonight. Oh, I'm afraid that's impossible, I said. You see, when they're having a tryout, he and the librettists and the lyric writers work all night, every night, until they get everything in shape for the New York opening. They never have time for more than a sandwich, and they eat that right in the theater. Well, how about luncheon tomorrow? He'll be rehearsing all day. How about dinner tomorrow evening? Honestly, Mrs. Thayer, it's out of the question. Mr. Drake never makes engagements during a tryout week. And I guess he doesn't want to meet us anyway, put in Mr. Thayer. What use would a genius like Ben Drake have for a couple of common no-account admirers like Mrs. Thayer and myself? If we were somebody too, it would be different. Oh, not at all, said I. Mr. Drake is perfectly human. He loves to have his music praised. I'm sure he'd be delighted to meet you if he weren't so terribly busy. Can you lunch with us yourself? Tomorrow? Any day? Well, whatever Ben and other husbands may think, there is no decent way of turning down an invitation like that. And besides, I was lonesome and the Thayers looked awfully nice people. I lunched with them and I dined with them, not only the next day, but all the rest of the week. And on Friday, I got Ben to lunch with them, and he liked them too. They were not half as gushing and silly as most of his fans. At dinner on Saturday night, they cross-examined me about our immediate plans. I told them that as soon as the show was over in New York, I was going to try to make Ben stay home and do nothing for a whole month. "I should think," said Mrs. Thayer, "be very hard for him to rest there in the city with the producers, publishers, and phonograph people calling him up all the time." I admitted that he was bothered a lot. "Listen, dearie," said Mrs. Thayer, "why don't you come to Lansdowne and spend a week with us? I'll promise you faithfully that you won't be disturbed at all. I won't let anyone know you're there. If any of our friends call on us, I'll pretend we're not at home. I won't allow Mr. Drake to even touch the piano. If he wants exercise, there are miles of room in our yard to walk all around, and nobody can see him from the street. All day, all night, he can do nothing or anything just as he pleases. It will be Liberty Hall for you both. He needn't tell anybody where he is, but if some of his friends or business acquaintances find out and try to get in touch with him, I'll frighten them away. How does that sound?" It sounds wonderful," I said, "but it's settled then," said Mrs. Thayer, "and we'll expect you on Sunday, October 11th. "Oh, but the show may not be set by that time," I remonstrated. "Well, how about the 18th, said Mrs. "Well, it ended up by my accepting for the week of the 25th, and Ben took it quite cheerfully. If they stick to their promise to keep us undercover, he said, it may be a lot better than staying in New York. I know that Buck and the Schuberts and Ziegfeld want me while I'm hot, and they wouldn't give me a minute's peace if they could find me. And of course, if things aren't as good as they look, Irene's telegram will provide us with an easy out." On the way over to Philadelphia, he hummed me an awfully pretty melody, which he'd been running through his head since we left the apartment. "I think it's surefire," he said. "I'm crazy to get to a piano and fool with it." "Well, now, that isn't resting, dear. Well, you don't want me to throw away a perfectly good tune. They're not so plentiful that I can afford to waste one. It won't take me 5 minutes at a piano and get it fixed in my mind." The Thayers met us in an expensive-looking limousine. "Ralph," said Mrs. Thayer to her husband, "you sit in one of the little seats with Mr. and Mrs. Drake. Will sit back here with me." "Oh, I'd really prefer one of the little seats myself," said Ben. And he meant it, for he hates to get his clothes mussed. And being squeezed in besides two such substantial objects as our hostess and myself was bound to rumple them. "No, sir," said Mrs. Thayer positively. "You came to us for a rest, and we're not going to start off uncomfortable. But honestly, it was no use. Ben was wedged between us, and throughout the drive maintained a morose silence, unable to think of anything but how terrible his coat would look when he got out. The Thayers had a very pretty home, and the room assigned to us was close to perfection. There were comfortable twin beds with a small stand and a convenient reading lamp between, a big dresser and a chiffonier, an ample closet with plenty of hangers, a bathroom with hot water that was hot, towels that were not too new, and faucets that stayed on when turned on, and an ashtray within reach of wherever you happen to be. If only we could have spent all our time in that guest room, it would have been ideal. But presently, we were summoned downstairs to luncheon. I had warned Mrs. Thayer in advance, and Ben was served with coffee. He drinks it black. "Don't you take cream, Mr. Drake?" "No, never." "That's because you don't get good cream in New York." "No, it's because I don't like cream in coffee." "You would like our cream. We have our own cows, and the cream is so rich, it's almost like butter. Won't you try just a little?" "No, thanks. But just a little to see how rich it is." She poured about a tablespoon of cream into his coffee cup, and for a second I was afraid he was going to pick up the cup and throw it in her face. But he kept hold of himself, forced a smile, and declined a second chop. "You haven't tasted your coffee," said Mrs. Thayer. "Yes, I have," lied Ben. "The cream is wonderful. I'm sorry it doesn't agree with me." "I don't believe coffee agrees with anyone," said Mrs. Thayer. "While you're here not doing any work, why don't you try to give it up?" "I'd be so irritable, you wouldn't have me in the house. Besides, it isn't plain coffee that disagrees with me. It's coffee with cream." "Pure, rich cream like ours couldn't hurt you," said Mrs. Thayer. And Ben, defeated, refused to answer. He started to light a Jaguar cigarette, the brand he'd been smoking for years. "Hey, wait a minute," said Mr. Thayer. "Try one of mine." "What are they?" asked Ben. "Trumps," said our host, holding out his case. "They're mild and won't irritate your throat." "I'll sample one later," said Ben. "You've simply got to try one now," said Mr. "You may as well get used to them because you'll have to smoke them all the time you're here. We can't have guests providing their own cigarettes." So Ben had to discard his Jaguar and smoke a Trump, and it was even worse than he had anticipated. After luncheon, we adjourned to the living room, and Ben went straight to the piano. "Hear, hear, none of that," said Mrs. Thayer. "I haven't forgotten my promise." "What promise?" asked Ben. "Didn't your wife tell you? I promised her faithfully that if you visited us, you wouldn't be allowed to touch the piano." "But I want to," said Ben. "There's a melody in my head that I'd like to try." "Oh, yes, I know all about that," said Mrs. Thayer. "You just think you've got to entertain us. Nothing doing. We invited you here for yourself, not to enjoy your talent. I'd be a fine one to ask you to my house for a rest and then make you perform." "You're not making me," said Ben. "Honestly, I want to play for just 5 minutes. I've got a tune that I might do something with, and I'm anxious to run it over." "I don't believe you, you naughty man," said our hostess. "Your wife has told you how wild we are about your music, and you're determined to be nice to us. But I'm just as stubborn as you are. Not one note do you play as long as you're our guest." Ben favored me with a stricken look, mumbled something about unpacking his suitcase, it was already unpacked, and we went up to our room where he stayed nearly an hour jotting down his new tune, smoking Jaguar after Jaguar and wishing that black coffee flowed from bathtub faucets. About a quarter of four, Mr. Thayer insisted on taking him around the place and showing him the shrubbery. Something that held in Ben's mind a place of equal importance to the grade of wire used in hairpins. "I'll have to go to business tomorrow," said Mr. Thayer, "and you will be left to amuse yourself. I thought you might enjoy this planting more if you knew a little about it. Of course, it's much prettier in the spring of the year." "I can imagine so. You must come over next spring and see it. I'm usually busy in the spring," said Ben. "Before we go in," said Mr. Thayer, "I'd like to ask you one question. Do tunes come into your mind and then you write them down? Or do you just sit at the piano and improvise until you strike something good?" "Sometimes one way and sometimes the other," said Ben. "That's very interesting," said Mr. Thayer. "I've often wondered how it was done. And another question, do you write the tunes first and then give them to the men who write the words? Or do the men write the words first and then give them to you to make up the music to them?" "Sometimes one way and sometimes the other." "Very interesting," said Mr. Thayer. "It's something I'm glad to know. And now we better join the ladies or my wife will say I'm monopolizing you." They joined us, much to my relief. I had just reached a point where I would either have to tell Hilda exactly how much Ben earned per annum, or that it was none of her business. "Well," said Mrs. Thayer to Ben, "I was afraid Ralph had kidnapped you." "He was showing me the shrubbery," said Ben. "What did you think of it?" "It's a great shrubbery," said Ben, striving to put some warmth into his voice. "You must come and see it in the spring. I'm usually busy in the spring. Ralph and I are mighty proud of our shrubbery." "You have a right to be." Ben was taking a book out of the bookcase. "What book is that?" asked Mrs. Thayer. "It's The Great Gatsby," said Ben. "I've always wanted to read it, but I never got around to it." "Heavens!" said Mrs. Thayer, and she took it away from him. "That's old. You'll find the newest ones there on the table. We keep pretty well up to date. Ralph and I are both great readers. Just try any one of those books in that pile. They're all good." Ben glanced over at them and selected Chevron's. He sat down and opened it. "Man, man!" exclaimed Mrs. Thayer. "You've picked the most uncomfortable chair in the house." "He likes straight chairs," I said. "That's on the square," said Ben. "But you mustn't sit there," said Mrs. Thayer. "It makes me uncomfortable just to look at you. Take this chair here. It's the softest, nicest chair you've ever sat in." "I like hard, straight chairs," said Ben. But he sank into the soft, nice one and again opened the book. "Oh, you never can see there," said Mrs. Thayer. "You're in your eyes. Get up just a minute and let Ralph move your chair by the lamp. I can see perfectly well. I know better. Ralph, move his chair so he can see." I don't believe I want to read just now anyway," said Ben, and he went to the phonograph. "Bess," he said, putting on a record, "here's that Oh, Miss Hannah by the Revelers." Mrs. Thayer fairly leaped to his side and herded Miss Hannah back into her stall. "Oh, we've got lots later ones than that," she said. "Let me play you the new Gershwins." It was at this juncture that I began to suspect our hostess of a lack of finesse. After all, Gershwin is a rival of my husband's, and in some folks' opinions, a worthy one. However, Ben had a word of praise for each record, and it ended, and it did not even hint that any of the tunes were based on melodies of his own. "Mr. Drake," said our host at length, "would you like a gin cocktail or a Bacardi?" "Oh, I don't like Bacardi at all," said Ben. "Oh, I bet you like the kind I've got," said Mr. Fairley. "It was brought to me by a friend of mine who just got back from Cuba. It's the real stuff." "I don't like Bacardi," said Ben. "Wait till you taste this one." Well, we had our Bacardi cocktails. I drank mine. It wasn't so good. Ben took a sip of his and pretended it was all right. But he had told the truth when he said he didn't like Bacardi. I won't go into details regarding the dinner, except to relate that the three separate items were highly flavored with cheese. And Ben despises cheese. "Don't you care for cheese, Mr. Drake?" asked Mr. Thayer, noticing that Ben was not exactly bolting his food. "No," replied the guest of honor. "He's spoofing you, Ralph," said Mrs. Thayer. "Everybody likes cheese." There was coffee, and Ben managed to guzzle a cup before it was desecrated with pure cream. We sat down to bridge. "Do you like to play families or divide up?" "Oh, we like to play together," said I. "Oh, I bet you don't," said Mrs. Thayer. "Suppose Ralph and you play Mr. Drake and me. I think it's a mistake for husbands and wives to be partners. They're likely to criticize one another and say things that might leave a scar." Well, Mr. Thayer and I played against Ben and Mrs. Thayer, and I lost 60 cents at a tenth of a cent a point. Long before the evening was over, I could readily see why Mrs. Thayer thought it was a mistake to play with her husband. And if it had been possible, I would have left him a complete set of scars. Just as we were getting to sleep, Mrs. Thayer knocked on our door. "I'm afraid you haven't covers enough," she called. "There are extra blankets on the shelf in your closet." "Thanks," I said. "We're warm as toast." "I'm afraid you aren't," said Mrs. Thayer. "Lock the door," said Ben, before she comes in and feels our feet. All through breakfast next morning, we waited in vain for the telephone call that would yield Irene's message. The phone rang once and Mrs. Thayer answered, but we couldn't hear what she said. At noon, Ben signaled me to meet him upstairs, and there he stated grimly that I might do as I choose, but he was leaving Liberty Hall ere another sun set. "You haven't any excuse," I reminded him. "I'm a genius," he said, "and geniuses are notoriously eccentric." "Geniuses' wives sometimes get eccentric, too," I said, and began to pack up. Mr. Thayer had gone to Philadelphia, and we were alone with our hostess at luncheon. "Mrs. Thayer," said Ben, "do you ever have premonitions or hunches?" She looked frightened. "Why, now, do you?" "I had one not half an hour ago. Something told me that I positively must be in New York tonight. I don't know whether it's business or illness or what, but I've just got to be there." "That's the strangest thing I ever heard of," said Mrs. Thayer. "It scares me to death." "But it's nothing you need be scared of," said Ben. "It only concerns me." "No, yes, but listen," said Mrs. Thayer. "A telegram came for you at breakfast time this morning. I wasn't going to tell you about it because I'd promised that you wouldn't be disturbed. And it didn't seem so terribly important, but this hunch of yours puts the matter in a different light. I'm sorry now that I didn't give you the message when I got it, but I memorized it, and I can repeat it word for word. Mr. Ben Drake, care of Mr. Ralph Thayer, Lansdowne, Pennsylvania. In Nile song, second bar of refrain, bass drum part reads A flat, which makes discord. Should it be A natural? Would appreciate your coming to theater tonight to straighten this out. As harmony must be restored in orchestra if troupe is to be success. Regards, Gene Buck. Sounds silly, doesn't it, said Ben, and yet I have known productions to fail and lose hundreds of thousands of dollars just because an author or composer left town too soon. I can well understand that you considered the message trivial. At the same time, I can thank my stars that this instinct or divination or whatever you want to call it told me to go home. Just as the trainmen were shouting all aboard, Mrs. Thayer said, I have one more confession to make. I answered Mr. Buck's telegram. I wired him, Mr. Ben Drake resting at my house must not be bothered. Suggest that you keep bass drum still for a week. And I signed my name. Please forgive me if I've done something terrible. Remember, it was for you. Small wonder that Ben was credited at the Lambs Club with that month's most interesting bender.
Christina Pickles read Liberty Hall by Ring Lardner. This story is available on our CD collection, Travel Tales, as well as other wonderful readings by this remarkable actor on our CD anthologies entitled Food Fictions, Lots of Laughs, and Falling in Love. For details, go to selectedshorts.org. We know you like to listen to short stories, but if you can write them too, enter our annual Stella Kupferberg Memorial Short Story Contest. This year's theme is Tales That Surprise. For more details on the contest, including the deadline and the prize, visit our website at selectedshorts.org. Selected Shorts is produced by Catherine Minton and directed by Isaiah Sheffer. The executive director of Symphony Space is Cynthia Elliott. Our radio producer is Sarah Montague, and our production assistant is Miranda Schaefer. The readings are recorded by Miles B. Smith, and our mix engineer is Stu Kennedy. Major support for Selected Shorts is provided by Houghton Mifflin, publishers of the Best American Short Stories, edited in 2008 by Salman Rushdie, and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873, and on the web at bn.com. Additional support is provided by the Dungannon Foundation, sponsor of the Ray Award for the Short Story, Budget Travel, the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art, the New York State Council on the Arts, a state agency, the Henry Nias Foundation, and the Lila Acheson Wallace Theater Fund of the New York Community Trust. Selected Shorts is a co-production of Symphony Space and WNYC Radio in New York and is distributed nationwide by PRI, Public Radio International.
Support for this program comes from this station and Public Radio International stations nationwide and is made possible in part by the PRI Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.